Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
My best and most healthy relationship snuck up on me. I was in my late teens and started the relationship thinking I'd have a summer fling and maybe learn a little bit about dating in the process. I told myself, I'll dump him in September when school starts again. And then I ended up falling in love with him. We were together 5.5 years. Since then, I've had a string of relationships where the driving force was passion. It starts out strong with a blast of wild intensity and an all-encompassing fervor, but they end up being emotionally unavailable. I wanted to know what was happening and found some answers in attachment theory, which is research on the types of people we're attracted to and what happens when we get together. After delving into the attachment research, I started to purposefully date people who were better for me, but this came with much less excitement and passion. I found the process a little discouraging and a bit overwhelming. Dating like this was new territory. I became interested in doing a story on dating differently. I was curious about how this worked for others. And then I happened to bump into Mark at a party. He had gone through something similar, and he was willing to share his story. Mark and Eileen were set up by a couple of friends, and it was a bit awkward at first.
It was kind of a strange thing. It's, you know, when your parents tell you to talk to their friend's kid, it felt a bit like that. Kind of a forced conversation.
As Mark will say, he felt obligated to talk to me.
Regardless, they ended up staying up most of the night and even took in the sunrise together. But it wasn't an instant connection. They went out a couple more times, but they didn't really pursue each other. After some prodding from friends on both sides, they start to date a bit more consistently.
In the beginning, I have to say part of it was that I kept thinking to myself, Mark's kind of crazy and he does all these wild things, but like he has very down-to-earth, lovely friends. And that was kind of like a stabilizing factor where I was like, you know what, I'm going to like see what's going on with this guy. Because I felt like he had some great characteristics. We had a lot of fun together. We had some stuff in common, but there were certain things like the lack of commitment and other things that would drive me a bit crazy.
Things like Mark finding it hard to commit to any plans with Eileen in case something better came along. Or about how she'd barely see Mark when they went to parties together because he'd be off socializing and only realize he hadn't spoken to her all night when she'd find him to say goodnight. And these were the early days where you might expect just the opposite.
It was like pretty early on, like it must have been at like about a month or something. And I just said very casually to Mark, how do you think things are going? Which I thought was like a very normal question to ask someone that you had dated a bunch of times and seen a couple times a week for a month. And he, like, took this long pause, and then he was like, well, I'd say I'm about 60% into you.
In my mind, I tend to think in terms of, I guess, too much like an engineer. And so I was trying to explain my rationale in terms of the way I'd been thinking previously about relationships starting at 100% and only dwindling. So trying to explain to her that, you know, I'm not at 100%, but it's increasing.
And I was so taken aback because first, definitely wasn't expecting a number. Like I had not expected him to like quantify it in numerical form. Secondly, I felt like 60 seemed like really low.
It's on the right side of 50% was what I was thinking. And it was only going to increase from there.
And he seemed like pretty delighted with this. And then he followed up by, no, well, it started way lower. I mean, I don't think like I'm an egoist, but at the same time, I don't feel like, you know, I need to be at a place where it's like, oh, well, look what the cat dragged in. Like, you know, I was also someone who's used to being a fairly high achiever. And to me, like 60 didn't seem that good. And I didn't really want to like know that. But that kind of speaks to Mark's like brutal honesty. He'll just say it like it is, you know.
Most of Mark's previous relationships started off quite differently. He was swept away by excitement and passion. They'd hook up and fall into relationship within a week's time. but they didn't last long.
I kind of notoriously had like a 3-month limit for my relationships and then would move on.
This is where attachment theory might come in handy. It's a psychological model that attempts to describe the dynamics of long and short-term relationships between humans. It's actually really accurate at predicting how people will behave in romantic relationships and whether they'll be matched based on their attachment styles. I found it immensely illuminating in my own life. It gave some context to the pattern I started to become aware of, one of being attracted to emotionally unavailable men and also being somewhat turned off people who were just the opposite and were available and present. Considering I've been a therapist for 10 years, you could say I came upon this info embarrassingly late, but I guess it's always easier to see what's happening in someone else's life than your own. There are 4 attachment types. People with a secure attachment are warm and loving. Relationships come easily to them, and they're great at communicating their needs and feelings. They're also comfortable with intimacy and independence. They're like the gold standard. People with an anxious attachment tend to be stressed out about their relationships. They love being very close to their partners, and they have the capacity for a lot of intimacy. However, they need a lot of reassurance and affection. People with an avoidant attachment style are fiercely independent and are often uncomfortable with intimacy. For them, the idea of commitment can be scary. They often construct their lifestyle in order to avoid commitment or too much intimate contact. So even though they want to be in relationship, they tend to keep their distance. The last attachment style is the combination of anxious and avoidant. With this type, the person is uncomfortable with intimacy and commitment, and at the same time, they have a strong desire to be in relationship. So how exactly do these attachment styles develop? They're actually formed through interactions with our parents as infants. Mark's 3-month relationships unfolded in relatively the same way. The first month was fun and full of passion. The second month, as Mark put it, they'd be coasting. And by the third month, things already started to feel a bit old. No longer in the honeymoon phase, he would get antsy and bored. Small superficial things that his partner did would start to annoy him.
It was really silly. It was just like wearing the same ratty pants over and over. It was just something that I noticed that stood out. No longer kind of this perfect image that I had of the person.
Through the attachment theory lens, our reactions to our partner's small imperfections would be seen as an avoidant type's distancing reaction to the idea of commitment. And this can all happen subconsciously.
And that's where I noticed also that it wasn't so much about the person, but it was also about me and how I approach the relationships. I realized if I want to have a relationship that lasted longer than 3 months, I needed to learn to appreciate those things and be able to accept how a person is. I think it was just realizing that after seeing that pattern numerous times that it wasn't sustainable and this can't be how you build a long-term relationship.
I asked Mark and Eileen to read over a summary on attachment styles to see where they identified themselves on the attachment spectrum.
Maybe Eileen can answer better for me.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. He definitely started out with feeling uncomfortable when things are too close and intimate and valuing
really?
Independence and freedom. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is like classic. Mark is always surprised when I say something that I think is like completely obvious. I'll be like, oh, well, Mark really likes, you know, chicken. He's like, chicken? What do you mean I like chicken?
I guess I don't see myself in any boxes. So when someone sees me in a box, I'm always surprised by it.
Mark's reaction is understandable. Even though we may have a dominant attachment style, it's on a spectrum. So in most cases, we can have a bit of all styles in varying quantities. I take a guess that Mark would fall into the avoidant category. And Eileen sounds like a mixture of anxious and secure. You can see it playing out where Mark's more distant at first, and Eileen's looking for reassurance while still remaining grounded. I'm simplifying this all a bit, but you get it. There are predictable ways that the different attachment types tend to configure themselves into relationships. Secure types are capable of dating both anxious and avoidant types. They're comfortable enough with themselves to give anxious types all the reassurance they need and to give avoidant types the space they need without feeling threatened themselves. But opposites also attract. Anxious types are drawn to avoidant types, and vice versa. For anxious types, avoidant types validate their abandonment fears and an insecurity of not being enough. In turn, avoidant types need someone to pursue them to meet the emotional needs that they subconsciously disown. I learned through my research that I was stuck in what's called the anxious-avoidant trap. I was the anxious one in this scenario. It was explained that I was attracted to avoidant types because they activated my attachment system. The attachment system is needed for survival. It's the system responsible for babies attaching to their caregivers. And it's the same system working in romantic relationships. So as an anxious person, getting mixed messages from an avoidant type and the tension that can arise from that activates the attachment system, which puts the person into overdrive to make the relationship work. And the feeling created in that reaction can get mixed up for feelings of like or love. And the other hard part is that if an anxious type meets someone who's secure and much better suited, the attachment system doesn't get activated. There's less drama, which can cause feelings of boredom. So if you're an anxious type, there's a good chance you'll automatically interpret calmness in the relationship as lack of attraction.
I would say Mark is like very comfortable with intimacy, and I'd say that you don't obsess where the relationship's going or my ability to love you back. I would say he's moved towards this.
Meaning secure attachment.
For me, I would probably have started out more with like having some insecurity about where the relationship was going, and some of the things Mark did like really setting me off and driving me crazy. So more in the anxious and then gone more into the secure. We started in different boxes but ended up in the same one.
And that's exactly what can happen. Our attachment styles aren't fixed, thank goodness. They may lead us astray at points, but it's possible to develop a secure attachment at any age. Change occurs mostly when you get into a relationship that really shakes your beliefs about love. If, for example, you expect people to let you down or reject you once they get to know the real you, and then you meet someone who's supportive and loving no matter what, over time, you'll likely become more secure. So even though we don't have control over the type of attachment style that gets formed in infancy, we're not doomed.
I think I remember the turning point there. It was a discussion where we had where I guess a lot of couples have that, their like first fight, but then realizing that the person's going to stick through it. And I think that's where things probably kind of changed. Whereas in my previous relationships, it would have been like, okay, time to move on. Whereas this then was like, oh, okay, well, even if things are rough, this person's going to stick it out and we'll figure it out and work through it. I guess it just, for me, was not a pattern that I had been used to in my previous relationships. And so knowing that having a fight wasn't the end of the relationship was, I think, a really positive thing.
What was it that showed you, hey, this isn't going to be the end of us?
I think it was her reaction saying, you know, that we're not breaking up. Just even hearing that was a very good thing for me to hear. And I'm holding her to it now. And now we're at the point where I like talking about things a lot more than Eileen does.
Yeah, Mark's an excellent communicator.
I have to admit, I was disappointed by their story. Even a bit bored. Was that it? No big ups and downs. No big revelations. Just two people growing together and finally realizing their opposite traits are complementary. And then I realized I was still chasing excitement. If not through my own story, but through others. And it's not about excitement. It's about companionship, which can still involve excitement. Mark and Eileen have tons of fun together. They play, they joke. They're cool folks. In my own life, trying to break the pattern hasn't been easy. I've come up with the term dating in the middle to describe my experience. I'm trying not to run after fireworks, but I also need to feel something. So I guess that's the middle. But it's all still pretty new. When I meet someone nice and attractive enough, who I might not feel wildly excited about, I think, give this a chance. But also, I keep reminding myself that distance is my kryptonite, I think danger, stay away, but I'm still pulled towards it. It's not easy out there, especially when my compass has been stuck pointing north to emotionally unavailable men for years. It's going to take some time getting comfortable dating differently, but I think it might be worth it.
Part of my philosophy now in terms of being in a long committed relationship and my fear of missing out, you know, is that this is a great opportunity to have this lifelong commitment to someone. And if I'm not faithful, it will actually ruin that. And that's what I'm going to be missing out. I'd be missing out on a lifelong partner and building a life together with someone. And so it's just kind of turning it around, kind of using my weaknesses as a strength.
And so how many years in now?
11.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're close to 100% now too.
Thanks for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby in the unceded Coast Salish territories. This week, a documentary by Carrie Swigum as part of the Making Time for Radio documentary series funded by CJSF. The documentary is about the Hotel Vancouver and the World War II veterans that took it for themselves. When World War II veterans returned home to start their lives, many found themselves homeless, couch surfing. In a coup, they took over the then vacant Hotel Vancouver, now peeling and crumbling, and declared it an army barracks for returning vets. The hostel, as it was known, lasted for 2 years before it was eventually torn down. This is that story, the story of two Hotel Vancouvers.
January 26, 1947. It's been a year since the men moved in. Soon after came whole families, a place to call their own.
Fighting the Germans, they were not going to just, you know, kowtow to the government. They were just fighting force, right?
Claudia Cornwall is a writer from North Vancouver. In 2006, she wrote a magazine article that was published in the Tyee called The Night War Vets Seized the Vancouver Hotel. And Claudia spoke with some of the people who lived there.
They were used to, to moving in. And I mean, they were disarmed and nobody was, I think, really worried about, you know, serious violence, but they were not going to let some kind of lily-livered person who had no experience of the war tell them what to do. I mean, these guys were powerful people and they were victors. You know, I think they sort of chuffed a bit, you know, they weren't going to be bullied by bureaucrats.
Besides newspaper archives, there's not much written about the takeover and the 2 years that veterans lived in the hotel, nor the demonstrations that forced the government to build hundreds of low-income housing for the servicemen and their families. As for the veterans, there are few left to tell their tale. They came back to a changed city after the war, and them changed men and women.
There was a huge population increase between 1939 and 1944 already. You know, it wasn't just the service people that were affected by this, of course. All kinds of people moving to Vancouver. There was a terrific pressure on whatever housing stock there was.
People knew there was a crisis going on. Construction had almost halted during the war. In 5 years, more than 40,000 people moved into the city. Add that to the returning vets, who now decided to call Vancouver and Toronto home, and the almost 50,000 war brides who arrived in Canada from Europe during 1945 and 1946.
You'll see. I mean, there was a terrific movement of people in those days, so there just wasn't any place for anybody to stay.
All around the city, posters urged homeowners to rent out any space that they had available. During the war years, a government organization called the National Housing Registry handled about 1,600 applications for housing in Vancouver every month.
Wanted immediately, living quarters for war workers and their families. There is still idle accommodation in Vancouver, left vacant when children married or left home to join the fighting service. If you have usable space in your home, you will be doing a valuable war job, helping to relieve a housing crisis by renting it as family dwelling units to war workers and their wives and children. Many Vancouver residents have already responded generously to the appeal, but more are needed.
The Vancouver Tourist Association complained, "We can't have people coming here on business and then having to virtually sleep in the streets." Newspapers reported that visitors slept in hotel lounges. There were calls to do something. Instead, there were several hundred rooms in the hotel. But after the war, the building was slated for demolition.
Certainly, housing and real estate prices have been a feature of Vancouver ever since its inception. You can look back at newspaper articles from the 1890s or 1910s decrying the cost of housing in Vancouver and saying how astronomical prices are and when will they come down, and not anytime soon.
This is Will Woods. He does walking tours of Vancouver's storied past.
So if you, we rewind to the 1880s, where you've got the Canadian Pacific Railway heading westwards, building its rail line, you know, coast to coast. And as much as a company that made money from the railway, it was equally, maybe even more so, a company that made money on real estate.
Town sprouted overnight on the mere whisper of a rail line. Railroads controlled much of the real estate in growing western cities.
You really can't separate the history of the various, I don't know if it's Hotel Vancouver's or Hotels Vancouver that we've had in the city, from the history of the Canadian Pacific Railway in particular and rail companies generally in Canada.
We're talking about the second Hotel Vancouver. The first outgrew itself in 15 years, and the one that stands today is the third building.
So they needed to establish a center here, a reason to come here, a reason for wealthy people to come here and buy land. And they figured that tourism was the most effective way to do this.
Looking out from the 15th floor, one could see a clear view of the North Shore Mountains rising up from the sea. Billowing steamships chug into the broad inlet, taking care to avoid the massive log booms. The arrival of the railroad helped transform Vancouver from a sleepy lumber town to a global city, and the Canadian Pacific cashed in.
It just seems bizarre to me today to think of the timeline of this hotel, of how grand it was, how much it cost to build. I think it was about $3 million, which was a lot of money in those days. Particularly, this was in the middle of World War I.
It was built to impress.
It lived up to its billing as a magnet for the great and the good to come and see Vancouver.
And well-known celebrities stayed there. Sarah Bernhardt, Babe Ruth, Winston Churchill, Mackenzie King, Warren G. Harding, and the Prince of Wales, to name a few.
It's one of the great hotels of the British Empire. Marble countertops in the bathrooms, gold-plated faucetry, a huge grand ballroom. There were gargoyles on the outside of the building of moose and buffalo and these other iconic animals of Western Canada. It was very, very ornate. Perhaps the most famous feature it had was the panorama roof, which was a kind of dance and dine club on the roof with an outdoor patio that, if you look at the old photographs, the view was phenomenal. As you can imagine, it became the place to go in the 1920s.
Oddly, for as grand as the hotel became known, it was closed within 23 years.
Going back to the railway companies, as the real story behind the history of this hotel, the Canadian Pacific Railway had a rival company, which was Canadian Northern, and they had a little old station on Pender Street. They didn't have a hotel. They're also bringing people here to Vancouver, and they're sending them to stay in their rival's hotel, the second Hotel Vancouver. So as you can imagine, they wanted their own hotel.
The Canadian National made a deal with the city way back in 1912. To fill in False Creek, build a big rail yard, and a grand new station, Pacific Central.
This was the federal government following through on a deal that had been made years earlier. They started work on what is the third Hotel Vancouver. Then the Great Depression struck. And then they're stuck. Oh no, we've got this half-finished hotel. We've got the second Hotel Vancouver. The city, the province, Canadian National, which is owned by the federal government, and the CPR, the Canadian Pacific Railway, got in a room together, and the province was pushing hard for make-work projects at that time. So it's no coincidence that City Hall was built around this time, that the Lionsgate Bridge was built then.
This was the end of the 1930s.
It's got to be built. We need the jobs. We've got to bring this area out of the Depression. It's almost like a miniature New Deal that you saw down in the States with a lot of infrastructure projects during the Great Depression. It's on a much, much smaller scale, but they wanted to create work. And the CPR said, well, yeah, we'll help do this. We'll help fund it. But we've already got a hotel. And we don't want to be left with two massive hotels downtown without enough people to fill them. We're gonna lose money. It doesn't make any sense. So we're going to close the second Hotel Vancouver.
The second hotel was supposed to be torn down by the end of 1939. The third one was standing two blocks away. But then something happened.
On the 1st of September 1939, at dawn, the Germans crossed into our territory. German Air Force and regular army...
And the hotel became Pacific HQ.
Without a declaration of hostilities.
Of course, during the Second World War, the second Hotel Vancouver, while it was not a hotel, it was not sitting empty. The government had, or the military had, were using it as a barracks. There were well over 1,000 men staying there, and they were storing blankets and mattresses and whatnot. Until you've now got these returning men living downtown and looking for somewhere to stay and noticing an enormous empty hotel right on their doorstep that no one's using.
The military completely vacated the hotel at the beginning of December 1945, with the wrecking crew scheduled the following spring. Pleas from the Tourism Association and veterans groups called to Ottawa to save the building. Its fate was now tied to negotiations between the province and the Prime Minister, each asking the other to do more, and getting nowhere.
I thought it was just so cool, you know, that they took matters into their own hands and, you know, did what needed to be done.
On the night that the vets stormed the hotel, it was cold and snowing.
It was a snowy day in 1946, and there was an ex-serviceman, Bob McEwen, who was camped on the evening, and he was camped in the Vancouver courthouse lawn with three of his mates to protest the acute shortage of housing.
Well, now you've done it. You've reached the McEwen residence.
It didn't take her long to find Bob, who was then 83 years old and living in a suburb of Los Angeles.
Hello.
Hello.
Is that Bob McEwen?
Yes.
Hi, it's Claudia Cornwall.
She interviewed him and a few other ex-servicemen about their experience living in the hotel for the article.
I suppose we could have gone to an expensive hotel, but we're just getting out of the army with no money, and we couldn't very well do that.
So that's Bob McEwen in 2006. In 1946, he was 21.
It was snowing, I remember that.
And they had just returned from overseas.
Everybody was talking about how ridiculous the shortage was, but the old Vancouver Hotel was still standing.
He wanted to do something. I mean, he was going to break the logjam. A lot of people thought this was an empty building. Why couldn't the vets live there? But nobody was doing anything about it. And so he just decided, he was a big man, a very strong man, and he just decided, well, he was going to do it. So he took matters into his own hands.
Well, we built a bonfire in the middle of the courthouse lawn. Didn't come. come to anything other than the fact that we put some signs up and it drew a bit of attention.
You're listening to a documentary.